All right, we'll start. Okay, first I'll just walk you through what the next couple weeks of your life will look like. Okay, so we have two lectures left besides today. So there's one next Monday, and then Concordia scheduled one next Tuesday as well as a makeup lecture for the holiday. As I mentioned last class, I won't be here. I have to go to a thesis defense. I'm leaving Tuesday. So there'll be a class next Monday. That will be the last class. There'll be a little material that we won't have a chance to cover. So what I'll do is I'll upload a video, and then the video will have that material. I'll try and do it before next class so that if you have questions about it, you can ask me next class about it. So in lieu of that, there'll be a video. Okay, and then next week, your assignments are due unless if you did not use your slip day on assignment one, then they're due according to the slip day policy. I added, there was one typo. I forgot a closing bracket on this question. So the closing bracket's here. And I added a little more detail. This people were a little confused by what it looked like. So there's a little more detail there. Is there any questions about last week's assignments, anything?
Yep. In Elgamal generalization, you need to have a mapping because all messages are not in GQ.
Correct, yeah.
And you have like A prime, A squared mod P, and A prime power 2 minus 1 mod P. 2 minus 1, is it like 1.5, or it's the inverse of 2 in the table?
So it's 1.5. So yeah, so the question is, in general, what we're going to do is we're going to map our integer to GQ, and we'll do that by squaring it, and then we want to take the square root of it. So how do we do the square root? So what we have to do is we have to invert the number 2 mod Q. Okay, so we're going to compute the inverse of 2 mod Q, and then we'll take A to whatever that result is mod P. Okay, so on your assignment, you'll have to do this when you do the decryption function. You'll decode to get the original message back. Okay, and then how to compute the square root, we did talk about also in an earlier lecture. We talked about how to reduce it. In fact, I think we did an example of it, but I'll see if I can find it quickly. Yeah, so we if you go back to lecture 8, we talk about how to find roots. And so you can see, so this is exactly the same, except for in this case, x is 2. Okay, it's a square root as opposed to an x root. So if you replace 2 in this example, then you can walk through in order to find it. Also, if you use Wolfram Alpha and you use the power mod function, I think you can just say, blah to the power of 1/2, and I think it works. So you don't even have to simplify the exponent if you don't want to. I seem to recall that works, but I'm not 100% sure. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let me just to sort of get us back on track, I'll recap what we talked about last time, which was Elgamal, and then we'll move on to the next topic. So Elgamal is an encryption scheme. Basically, there's three algorithms. So let's say that we have Alice, and we want to send an encrypted message to Bob. Okay. We're going to have a key generation algorithm. Okay. So Bob will be the person who runs this. So he'll run key gen. And what he's going to do is he's going to get a public key equals G to the secret key Or sometimes we usually write it as y equals g to the x. Okay, so this is his secret, and this is the public key. Okay, then encryption, who's going to do encryption? So Alice is the one that's running the encryption. Okay, so she's going to do encrypt. So she has some message that she wants to encrypt. The output of it we'll call C. In ElGamel, C has two components. So she picks a random number and she computes G to the R, and she takes the message and multiplies it by Y to the R. Okay. Now note that this is basically a random number, okay, because you take a number, in this case, Y is the public key, and you pick a random number. So when you exponentiate by a random number, the result is effectively a random number. So as a result, this whole second component is a message times a random number that looks like a random number. Okay. So as far as Eve's concerned, this just looks like a random number, and this looks like a random number as well. Okay. And to decrypt, Bob is going to run decryption. Okay. And what Bob wants to do is he sees this second component and he knows it's the message times y to the r. Okay. And he has no idea what y to the r is. Okay. It's some value. But if he can figure out what that number is, what y to the r is, then he can invert it and multiply it, and it will cancel out with this y to the r. So he basically, his first step is, what is y to the r? And then once I know what y to the r is, I can strip it off and recover m. Okay? So how do I get y to the r? Well, he knows g to the r, right? And he knows y equals g to the x. So if he takes g to the r and raises it to the x, that's the same as y to the r. Okay. So what he'll do is, to decrypt, he'll first compute y to the r equals this g to the r value raised to the x, okay? And then once he has y to the r, then he can take the second value, m times y to the r, and he can times it by the inverse of y to the r, or y to the minus r, okay? And then that's going to cancel these two. Now, how do we do y to the minus r? What is minus r? How do we exponentiate by a negative number? Okay, so if this is mod q, right? So what's minus r mod q? Q minus r. So we can add a q to it, and it won't change that value because it's mod q. That's a property. So when you're typing this in, especially in your assignment, remember, this can be q minus r. So once you know what q is, then you could subtract it. Now you have a positive integer, and that's just a normal modular exponentiation. Okay. So you can see the previous lecture for the full details, but this is just sort of a sketch, maybe a more intuitive sketch of how ElGamel actually works. Okay, questions about ElGamel? All right, so the next topic I want to talk about is called zero knowledge proofs. So this topic is hard. It's hard to understand. It's definitely the hardest thing in the course. It's going to be a little tricky. The reason I explain it is in other crypto courses, like when I took crypto as a graduate student, eventually you're going to see a signature algorithm. The standard one's called DSA, and it's quite complicated. There's about three or four values that are going back and forth, and it's really hard to get a sense of what's going on. I remember looking at it and just having no idea what's going on. So it turns out that what's going on is actually built from these zero knowledge proofs, and it's a little bit of an involved algorithm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to explain it to you as best as I can, so you can sort of see where it comes from. Just to motivate zero knowledge proofs, let me give you an example of a zero knowledge proof just so we get the right idea. So let's say that let's say I'm doing some sort of digital cash system, okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put some money in an envelope. So let's say I have an envelope and it's sealed, and I claim this envelope has a $100 bill in it, okay? And what I want you to do is I want you to sign the outside of the envelope and say, yep, it has $100. If you open this envelope up and it turns out it doesn't have $100, you know, you're on the hook for paying that $100, okay? So you want to be really sure that it actually has the $100 in the envelope, okay? Now, for whatever reason, I don't want to open the envelope up and show you that it has $100 in it, okay? Maybe I'm worried that you'll write down the serial number of that bill and be able to trace it or something like that, okay? So the question is, can I prove to you that this envelope has a $100 bill in it without actually opening it up and showing you that it has a $100 bill, or showing you the exact $100 bill that's inside that envelope? Okay? If I could do that, I can convince you of a secret fact. There's this sort of secret fact, like this envelope has the $100 bill in it. It's a secret. And so I'm able to convince you of a secret without telling you any information about the secret. Okay? So there's this component of a proof. So I'm proving something to you that this envelope has $100 in it. And there's also something that you're not learning anything about. You're not actually learning that there's anything in the envelope. Okay, so you have zero knowledge about what's actually in the envelope. So I'm able to prove it, and you're able to get zero knowledge about it. So that sounds impossible, right? It sounds like you probably can't do that. But it turns out you can. So first off, does anyone have any ideas how you might be able to do it? Not using cryptography, just think about it like a logic puzzle. Just throw out the first thing that comes to mind. Say it louder. Okay, so you could do something like the weight of the envelope. So in this case, you're trying to see what's inside of it without seeing. You're using a different metric to see what's inside. So what I'll do is I'll just cut out some newspaper that weighs the same as a $100 bill, and I'll put a $1 bill in which weighs the same as a $100 bill. Okay. Sure. So you could do something where you record it. Now, what you could do is put a $100 envelope into an envelope, record that, and then the envelope I gives you is a different envelope. But you're also opening it up. So when I watch the video, I'll see the exact $100 bill that goes into it as well. But it's a good idea. Okay, so you could have a trusted third party open it, so that's fine. So the nice thing about these zero-knowledge proofs, the motivation for them, is you can do them without a trusted party. So a trusted party is how we normally solve things in the real world. And so what this is going to do is it's going to let you do it directly as if there was a trusted party there, but the trusted party wasn't there. So that's the right motivation for why to do it. And that is a solution that works. But in this case, you can do it directly. We're not leaving until someone comes in.
Have the third party convince the other person so you don't have to convince anymore?
Okay, so we're not going to use a third party, but that could work as well. So if the third party would learn that particular value. So we don't want that scenario. We don't want anyone to learn the value of it.
Okay.
Okay, so there could be some sort of like seeing through it, light, weight, maybe like a clear envelope or something like that. So all of these are going to leak some information about what's inside. So what we want to do is we want to literally leak zero information. Okay, so I'll give you a hint that's not going to help you, but I'll give it to you anyway. So I'll tell you at the end of this protocol, I won't be 100% sure that the envelope has a $100 bill in it. Okay, so I'm going to have some statistical certainty, so I'll be 99% sure it does, but it won't be 100%. So it's not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, but it's proven with very high confidence. So there's a sort of statistical flavor to the solution.
Use the blockchain?
No, I help you.
Okay, perfect. Good. Did you know the answer? Yeah, you're waiting till the end to record it. Okay, so what if we use multiple envelopes? What if I give you 100 envelopes and I tell you they all have $100 in it? I want you to sign one of them saying it has $100 in it, but you can choose which one to sign, okay? And for the other 99, you can open them up. So what you'll do is you'll go into the stack, you'll pull one out, you'll open it and say, yeah, that does have $100 in it. Then you'll take a second one out of the stack, you'll open it, and you'll say, that has $200. And you're picking at random points in the stack, not from top to bottom, okay? And eventually you've opened 99 of these envelopes and 99 of them have $100 in it. And there's one envelope left on the table, right? A randomly chosen envelope. What's the probability that that has $100 in it given that the other ones did? Okay, it's not 100%, but it's 99%, okay? In other words, if I wanted to cheat you, right? What I would do is I would have one envelope that only has a dollar in it, okay? And 99 that have 100. And what you would do is I would hope that when you choose the envelope to sign, you choose that one envelope that has the $1 bill. If you don't, then you're going to open that one up and you're going to see that I tried to cheat you, okay? So you're going to catch me with 99% probability, okay? So in this case, you could actually sign an envelope even though you've never opened it and still have some confidence that it contains what I say it contains, okay? So that's the idea of a zero-knowledge proof. Okay. Technically, that's called a cut-and-choose protocol. It's slightly different than zero-knowledge proof, but that's sort of the most intuitive example I can give you of what a zero-knowledge proof is doing. Now, what we're going to do in cryptography is we're not going to talk about envelopes of cash. We're going to talk about something slightly different. So what I'm going to say is, let's say I give you a public key. Say an Algamal key. So I give you G, and I give you G to the X equals Y. Okay. Now notice that for every G and Y that you pick, let's say you just pick these at random, there is going to be some X that satisfies this equation, okay? So G raised to every power of X gives you every other possible value. So for two different values, G and Y, there is some X that satisfies it. But I don't necessarily know what that X is, okay? Maybe I just pick G and Y at random. And if I pick G and Y at random, can I compute what X would satisfy this equation? I can't, why not? Okay, so it's a discrete log, okay? I'd have to take the discrete log, okay? Or maybe there's two values that two other people chose. So maybe some other people chose G and Y, and I'm saying that this is my public key, even though it's not, and I stole this public key from someone else, okay? So just because you have a G and Y, it doesn't mean that you necessarily know the X that links the two, okay? So what this protocol is going to do is it's going to prove that you actually know an X value that satisfies this equation. Okay, you know an X value that if you take G and raise it to it, it will give you this Y value. Okay, but you're not going to leak any information about X. Okay, so that's why it's zero knowledge. So it's a proof because I'm proving to you that I know X. It's zero knowledge because I'm not going to tell you any information about X beyond the fact that I happen to know what that value is. Okay, if we think of X and Y not as numbers X and Y, but if we think of them as they're sort of what we use them for, we use them for public keys and private keys, this is equivalent to saying, I'll give you a public key and I'll prove to you that I know the private key that corresponds to it. Okay, I'm the owner of that public key. Okay, so this is going to take a few successive attempts to build up, but
what we want in a zero knowledge proof is we want it to be both a proof and we want it to be zero knowledge. So a proof means that you are satisfied at the end that I actually know X. And zero knowledge means you didn't learn anything about X. Certainly, you didn't learn the full value of X, and it's not appropriate even if you learn some information about X, like a single bit. Okay. So to give you a flavor of those two properties, let's just consider stupid things that aren't actual zero knowledge proofs. One that is definitely a proof but is not zero knowledge, and then we'll consider the opposite. What does it look like to be zero knowledge and not a proof? And then we'll try and put them together. Okay. So the simplest thing you could do is you could just send X. Okay? And because you're asserting it, we're not sure whether it's right or not. We'll call it X prime. So the prover is going to send this value X prime, and they're going to say this X prime is the right X value that will link these two values together. And then the verifier, or you if you're verifying that this proof is true, you're going to check whether g to the x prime actually is equal to y, okay? And if it is, then you say, yep, you do know an x that links that g to the x, such that g to the x equals y, okay? And if it isn't, then I don't know whether you know or not. Okay, so this is a proof, right? There's no doubt at the end. If this holds, if this is true, that person knew that X value, right? So what do we call it when a proof actually proves what it said it's out to prove? We say it's sound. So we call it the soundness of the proof. Okay, so this is a sound proof that you know X. Okay, is it zero knowledge? It's not, because you learn everything about X. Okay, you learn the full value of X. Okay, so this is not a zero knowledge proof, but it is a sound proof. It's a proof, but not a zero knowledge proof. Okay, how do we get a zero knowledge property? So zero knowledge means that I'm going to tell you something, and that something's not going to leak any information about X itself, okay? What I could do is I could just send you a random number. That's not going to prove anything because X isn't involved in that, but it's not going to leak any information about X. Another thing I could do is send, say, a random number added to X. So let's say the prover sends X prime plus R, where R is a random integer. Okay, in this case, X plus R doesn't leak anything about X. Okay, if you don't know what R is, we can set this equal to something. So it's equal to D. Okay, if I send X plus R, you don't know what D is. Why don't you know? Because you see D, and for every value of X, there's another value of R such that X plus R equals D. Okay, so it doesn't leak any information about X because every X value is possible. Okay, you can't even tell what the right X value is. So this isn't meant to be anything. Now, what does the verifier do? Well, this doesn't prove anything about X. You might as well just pick a random number and send it. Okay. So this is just an example to show you that something that is zero knowledge, but it's not a proof of anything. Okay, so the verifier doesn't have anything to do. There's nothing to verify because it's just you're just sending a random number essentially. Okay, so what we want is we want both properties. We want something like when you send X directly, then they can verify the verifier can verify that you actually know X. Okay, but we want something like where you send X plus a random number because that's not going to leak any information about X. Okay. So if you want, this is sort of like opening the envelope. How do I prove to you that there's $100 in it? I just open the envelope up and you see it. Okay, so that leaks everything about the envelope, but it doesn't actually satisfy. It is an actual proof. You are convinced that it did contain $100. In this case, it's like sending you an envelope and you can't even open it or do anything with it. You have no idea whether it has $100 in it or not. So there's nothing to verify, but it doesn't leak what's actually inside the envelope.
Okay, so we need that sort of way of combining the two statistically. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to do something very similar to this, okay? But what we're going to do is instead of giving you no information about R, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit of information about R so that it's not just a completely random number. So I'll just write down the protocol and then we'll look at why it works. And let me change this to A just because it will make the notation more consistent as we go across the different versions. Okay, so we're going to start the same way. We're going to choose a random number A. And we're going to send the same value, D equals A plus X plus A. Okay, but what we're going to do is we're going to send a second value, which is, we'll call it B, which is G raised to the power of A. Okay, now, if I give you G to the power of A, just look at this equation for now. Do you know any information about A? Why? Discrete log, okay? So this hides A under DLP, okay? So it's almost the same as attempt two. In attempt two, I picked this random integer. I didn't tell you anything about it, okay? Here I'm giving you G to the A, okay? But it's still not telling you anything useful about it, okay? So you know something about it, but it's not useful. You can't actually figure out what A is, okay? And notably, the verifier can actually do something useful here. So what the verifier can do is they can take B, multiply it by y. So y is the original number that we were trying to prove. Let me just put it on the side since it's on the other screen. And they can ask whether this is the same as g raised to the power of d. Okay, g raised to the power of d is going to be g times x plus a. Okay, and on this side of the equation, we have b, which is g to the a, times y, which is g to the x. So we have g to the a plus x equals g to the x plus a, which should be the same. Okay, so in other words, if I give you these three values and I choose them exactly as they are specified here, this equation will hold. Okay. This equation proves nothing about x, okay? So you don't learn anything about x, and this equation holds. The only question is, does this equation actually prove that you knew that value of x, okay? So x is involved in this equation, and there is something about this equation that's holding, okay? There is some equation that works out, okay? But could you only produce these three values, or rather these two values, B and D, such that you know X? Is there any way to produce them without actually knowing X? That's the question that we have to answer. Okay, so on zero knowledge, we're fine. Soundness, is this actually a proof of anything? Okay, we sent a bunch of values around, or what are we actually proving? So this equates to, can you produce a B and a D such that B times Y equals G to the D without knowing X? Okay, so can we, let's answer this question. Can we produce this value? So what can we do? Well, we can choose D, okay? And, well, let's start here. So let's say we just choose B at random. Okay, if we choose B at random, we know what Y is, so we can multiply them together. So we'll get some value here, whatever B times Y is, okay? And then we know what G is, but we don't know what D is. Can we compute D? So if we know what's on the left hand of this equation and we know what G is, how do we compute D? So D is going to be the discrete log of this base G, so we can't compute that. So we don't know how it works, okay? Okay, so we can't do that because of the discrete log problem. Now, the other thing we could do is start with D. So let's say we choose D. Now we have to compute the B value that's going to match it. Okay, what does B equal in this case? Well, B is going to equal Y inverse GD. Can we compute that value? Yes. Okay, there's nothing stopping us computing that value. We can take inverses, we can do modular exponentiation, we can do multiplication, okay? So this value is possible to compute, okay? So in other words, can we produce B and D such that this equation holds? Yes, we can, okay? We can do it without knowing X. So this is not a sound zero-knowledge proof. It doesn't prove that we know X because we can spit these values out, okay? But we're getting closer. I'll just put proof. Okay. Why are we getting closer? Well, notice that what we're doing is if we choose B before we choose D, then we can't compute these two values. Okay. If we choose D first, then we choose B, okay, then we can compute these values. Okay. So what if I can enforce the order in which you choose values? What if I can enforce the fact that you choose B first and then you're going to choose D after, okay? If somehow I can enforce that, then we'll always be in this case and then you can't compute these values without solving a discrete log, okay? Another way you could think of it is if I choose these values correctly, what is B? B is G raised to the power of A, okay? So in other words, if I'm doing this protocol correctly, I know the discrete log of B base G. I know some A to satisfy this equation, okay? What if somehow I was able to prove to you that I know an A? Let me go back here. Notice here that when I choose B, so I choose B equals Y to the minus 1 G to the D. Do I know a G that satisfies, could I compute an A value such that B equals G to the A? Okay, I can't do it. So this ends up equaling G to the D minus X, because Y is G to the X, okay? I don't know what this X value is, right? If I knew D minus X, then I could tell you the A value that satisfies this. Of course, I know what D is because I chose it. And if I know what D minus X is, then I know what X is, right? So I just figured out what X is. So in this case, it's not possible for me to compute this A value. So what I'm going to do is, what I want to do is I want to prove to you that I can compute these three values. A, D, and B. Sorry, I can prove D equals X plus A, and I can prove to you, I can give you this value B. This equation is going to hold. And in addition, I need to prove one more fact. I need to prove to you that I know the discrete log of B relative to G. Okay? If I can do that, then I can't set b equal to y minus the inverse of y times g to the d, because I don't know the discrete log of this whole thing. Okay? So if I can just prove to you that I know the discrete log of b, right, then in that case, then the whole proof holds together. Okay? Now, there's one big problem, and the big problem is, how am I going to prove to you that I know the discrete log of something? Okay? Well, it turns out that that's what we're doing. That's what this whole protocol is doing, right? This whole protocol is, let's come up with a proof such that I know the discrete log of some value, okay? So I know y equals g to the x, okay? So if I can solve this problem of proving to you that I know the discrete log of this, whatever protocol I'm using to prove to you that I know the discrete log of this, I could just use it to solve to prove to you that I know the discrete log of this, okay? So we have this sort of circular dependency, okay? But there's one difference. The difference is, think about attempt one. So attempt one was a proper proof. The only problem with it is it wasn't zero knowledge, right? Now, I can't use attempt one on g to the x, because then you're going to learn what x is, okay? That's going to leak my private key. But if I want to prove to you that I know the discrete log of b and a, this is a number I just made up. It's a random number I just chose, okay? And so I could use attempt one. If one way to prove to you that I know the discrete log between these values is just to tell you a, okay? If I just tell you a, that's not leaking any information about x, because this has nothing to do with x, okay? At least until you get this value d, okay? Once you get the value d, then this value does have something to do with x, and it also has something to do with the value a, which I just told you about, okay? But anyways, using attempt one on this by itself isn't going to leak you any information, okay? So let's use that. We'll use that as a sort of building block. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to do all of attempt three, but then we're going to do attempt one on just these two values here, okay? All right, so where does this lead us, okay? It turns out that this is a sound proof. Why is it sound? Well, we can't do this attack, because now we're stuck, because we're supposed to reveal what the a value is for b. We're supposed to break the discrete log value of this, and we can't do it because we don't know what x is, okay? Okay, so we can't fake B and D. The only way that we could fake B and D that worked, if we start with B and compute D, we can't do it because of the discrete log, okay? If we start with D and then compute B, we get stuck because we have to reveal the discrete log of B, and we don't know that value, okay? So we're going to get stuck on either way. So we're not going to be able to do this. So this is a perfectly sound proof. Is it zero knowledge? Okay, well, let's think about what the adversary knows. So the adversary, they see D equals so we'll call it the view of the adversary. So they see this value, okay, D equals A plus X. They see the value B
which equals g plus a. Okay, and they're going to see the value a now because we're going to leak it. Okay, can they compute what x is from these three values? Okay, if it's yes, why? Okay, so if we use this, we know that x equals d minus a. We know what d is because we're given it, and we know what a is now because we're giving it. Therefore, we know what x is. Okay, so it's not going to be zero knowledge. It's going to fully leak the value of x. Okay, and it's all because we revealed this a. Okay, so at the end of the day, we reveal the a. Now we have a soundproof, but we broke zero knowledge again, okay? So we're kind of going back and forth where we have something that's not sound, but it's zero knowledge, and then we reveal a bit more information, and it's sound, but now it's not zero knowledge, okay? So let's try one final iteration. Okay, so what's the high-level point? The high-level point is, if we reveal A, then we make it so that the person can't fake the proof, okay? But if we reveal A, then we're also going to make it so it's not zero knowledge, okay? So in other words, what we want is we want both. We want them to not be able to fake it, so we want them to think that they have to reveal A, okay? But then we can't let them actually reveal A, because if they reveal A, then it's going to leak X, okay? So what we want to do is we're going to set this up statistically. So instead of saying that you always reveal A or you never reveal A, what we're going to do is we're going to make the prover start computing some of these values and not tell them whether we're going to make them reveal A or not, okay? Then they're going to flip a coin, and then we're going to say, surprise, tell us what A is. Or surprise, compute us this value, d equals a plus x, okay? And what's going to happen is if they're going to cheat, what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to choose the very last value that they're going to send. So they're going to send d last. So we're going to make them basically send b before d. So they're going to have to decide whether they want to send a b such that they don't know the discrete log, okay? But it will hold, the equation will hold, or they can send a B where they do know the discrete log, but then they're not going to have this equation hold. Okay, so we're going to force them to choose, and they're not going to know which one's coming until they commit to how they chose B. And so we're going to catch them if they cheat, not all the time, we're going to catch them with 50% probability, but that's sort of good enough for now, and then we'll talk about how to repair that. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll start with attempt 3. Then we're going to flip a coin, okay? If it's heads, doesn't matter which way we go, but let's say if it's heads, then what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, use attempt 1, which is just send us the value of A. Send us the value of A such that we know that you chose B in this particular way. If it's tails, then we'll do what attempt 3 does, which is sound. So the prover sends d equals c plus a. Sorry, x plus a.
Okay, and in this case, it leaks no information about x because we don't know what a is. Okay, we don't. We only get a if it's heads, and if it's a, we never send anything to do with x. So let's actually break this down. Okay, then the verifier will check. So if it's heads, they'll check that B actually equals G to the A. And if it's tails, they'll check whether B times Y equals G to the A. Okay, so this turns out to be a zero-knowledge proof. It's really complicated. There's a lot of moving parts. But this turns out to be both sound and zero-knowledge. Okay, why is it zero-knowledge? That's the easiest property to see. Well, in one case, you're sending A. You're not even sending. If it's heads, you're not sending anything to do with X. X is nowhere in this whole protocol, so it obviously leaks no information about X. If it's tails, what you're sending is D equals X plus A. So you are sending a value that's functionally dependent on X. It's also dependent on some value A. And what information are you sending about A? Well, the only thing you're sending about A is B, which is G to the A. And we know from the discrete log problem, you can't get any information about A out of B, okay? So B tells you nothing about A. There's nothing else that you're sending, so you know nothing about A. And if you know nothing about A, then you're going to know nothing about X because you're adding it to something that you know nothing about. Okay, so it's not going to leak any information. Now, why is it sound? So we'll work out each case. But essentially, what you're going to do is we're going to go back to trying to break attempt three. And like I say, you're going to be faced with a choice of how you choose this B value. You're either going to choose this B value like this. And if you choose this, you can fake the proof without knowing what X is. But if you choose B in such a way, and I challenge you to open it up to show me the discrete log of B relative to G, then you're stuck. Okay? Alternatively, you could guess that I'm about to challenge you to open B up. Okay? So then you could choose B correctly. You could choose B equals G to the A such that you know that A value. But then if I challenge you to actually send me a D value that equals X plus A, you can't do that because you have no idea what X is. You know what A is, but you don't know what X is. Okay, so you're going to get caught either way with 50% probability. Okay. Okay, so soundness actually technically has two components. One is if you actually do know the discrete log, you should be able to always follow the protocol. So if you trace through it, you'll see that if the prover actually knows it, they can. Completeness. Complete. Not spot. Okay. So what we're going to say is that if the prover doesn't actually know what x is, and they try to cheat, they try to run this protocol even though they don't know what x is, they will be able to convince you some of the time, but 50% of the time you're going to catch them. Okay? And essentially what they're going to do is they're going to try and guess what your coin flip is going to be. So as a verifier, you're either going to the coin is heads or it's tails. Okay? And essentially, if I know what that coin flip is, if I guess correctly, then I'll adapt my strategy accordingly and I'll be able to get away with it. Okay? But if I think the coin toss is going to be heads and it turns out to be tails, or if I think it's going to be tails and it turns out to be heads, then I'm going to get caught. Okay? So the best strategy is to try and predict the coin. And if the coin is random, if it's unpredictable, then I have no idea what it's going to be, then I'm going to get caught with 50% probability. So we can consider every case. Okay, so what's going to happen is we'll call it a malicious prover, someone who doesn't know X. And so they're either going to guess heads or they're going to guess tails. And the actual challenge will either be heads or tails. Okay, and what I'm going to assert is if they guess correctly, if they predict the coin toss, they will get away with it. So they're going to get away with it in these two cells, but we're going to catch them in these two cells. Okay. Okay, so let's say I'm a malicious prover and I think that the coin toss is going to be heads. What does that mean? So if it's going to be heads, then what's going to happen is I'm going to have to send an A value such that B equals G to the A, okay? But I don't have to tell you anything about X, all right? So what I'll do in this case is I'll just choose B correctly. So I'm going to choose some value A at random, and then I'll send you a value B equals G to the A, and then I'll get heads as the coin toss. And then what I have to do is send you A. And I can do that, so that will work. Okay? But what happens if the coin toss is different? Okay? So I choose A at set Q, and I send B equals G to the A. Okay? Now all of a sudden I get tails instead of heads. And notice it's too late. I've already sent my B value. Okay, I chose to compute B in this particular way. I can't change it now. So I'm locked into this particular B value. Okay, what do I have to send? Well, what I have to send is I have to send D equals X plus A. That's how I should compute it. But basically, I have to send a D that's going to satisfy this particular equation. Okay. So I can't send D equals X plus A because I don't know what X is, okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have to send D such that, I'll write it smaller. B to the Y equals G to the D, okay? So what is this particular D value? Well, it's going to be D equals the discrete log base G of B times Y. Okay, can I compute what this value of D is? I can't, because I can't take discrete logs. I don't know anything about Y. I know what B is. I know what the discrete log of B is, but I don't know what it is for Y. Okay, if I knew the discrete log of Y, that's what I'm trying to do. That's X, right? So I'm not going to be able to break it. So I'm going to get caught in this case. Okay, what happens if I think it's going to be tails? If I think it's going to be tails, I know I have to send a value that's going to satisfy this equation. Okay, If I have to send a value that's going to send this equation, I'm not going to choose b to be the g to the a, okay? Instead, I'm going to choose b according to this equation, okay? So what I'll do is I'm going to send b equals y to the minus 1 g to the d. Then I know this equation is going to hold, okay? Then I'll get tails, and I'll say great. First off, I'll choose a d, and I can choose any d. So I'll choose d at random. Okay, I'll get tails. I'll say, great, here's the d, and it's a d that I pre-chose up here. So I'll send it. Okay, and in this case, because I chose b such that it equals y to the minus 1 gd, then it is the case that b times y is going to equal g to the d for these values. Okay, so I chose these values such that this equation holds. So the prover will say, yep, you actually know. Sorry, I put this in the wrong cell. This is when I get tails, when I'm expecting tails and I get tails. So that should actually be over here. Okay, so if I'm expecting tails and I get tails, then I follow this strategy. Now, what happens if I'm expecting tails? So I'm going to choose B. Notice, what's the difference here? It's just how you choose B. So what if I choose B here, but I get heads instead? Okay, so I'll follow the same protocol. So I'll start with a D. And I'll send B equals Y to the minus 1 D to the D. And all of a sudden, I get heads instead. And so now what do I have to send? Well, I have to send the discrete log of B relative to G. Okay, so I have to send A equals the log base G of this value. Okay, do I know the discrete log of this base G? Well, I know for this component it's D and I chose D. So I know the discrete log of this base G. But do I know the discrete log of y or y inverse? Okay, I don't, because that's x. It's actually minus x. If it were possible to figure out the discrete log of something by just inverting it, you could just take any value you want the discrete log of, you can invert it for free and then compute the discrete log of it. So that can't be possible. Okay, so finding the discrete log of y inverse is the same as finding the discrete log of y in terms of how hard it is. And you can't find that discrete log. If you could, then we wouldn't be doing this whole zero knowledge proof, because that's the value x itself. Okay, so you'll get caught in this particular case. Okay, so what that means is that this protocol is sound. It's only 50% sound. But essentially it is a zero knowledge proof. So it's never going to leak any information about what X is. And it actually is a proof 50% of the time. 50% of the time I actually can only complete it if I actually know the proper value of X. Okay? Notice, if I know the proper value of X, I'm not going to follow. This is what a malicious prover is doing. Okay? If I know the proper value of X, then I'll follow the actual protocol itself. So I'll choose A correctly. And then I can just send d equals x plus a because I know this particular value of x. Okay, now let's say that we want to do this in real life. How do I, so now you can just forget about the details. Just think of it as a black box. You have a bunch of math. So we're going to do this protocol. You're going to say, yeah, I know this private key that belongs to this public key. Okay, we do a bunch of math. We send a bunch of values back. Maybe you follow it, maybe you don't follow it. But at the end of the day, I'm convinced that you actually know that public key, but I'm only 50% convinced. Okay. How can I, but I want to be 100% or as close to as possible. Let's say I want to be 99% convinced that you do it. How can we, what can we do?
You do it multiple times.
Exactly. So what I can do is we can just repeat the protocol. So we'll do it once, and if you answer correctly, then I'm 50% sure. And then we'll do it twice, and if you answer correctly, now I'm 75% sure. And then you'll do it three times, and I'm, you know, and the probability will get closer and closer to 100. And it will actually get close really, really fast, exponentially close, okay? So if you think of it the opposite way, what's the probability of getting away with it? Well, the probability of getting away with it first, on the first attempt, it's a half. To get away with it two times in a row, it's a quarter. And to get away with it three times, it's an eighth, and then a 16th. And so the probability of getting away if we do it t times is going to be 1 over 2 to the power of t. So if t is 100, like that's such a small number, it's basically a negligible number. Even if t gets to 20, then it's like 99. So if we do this 20 times back and forth, I'm going to be 99.99999% sure that you actually know that particular key. Okay, so that's fine. So we have a way. So just because it's 50%, that's not really a big stumbling block for us. Okay. Now, it turns out that we can actually do a little better. Even repeating it 20 times, it's a lot of values that are going back and forth. Okay, so we can improve it slightly. Before I improve it, what I want to do is I'm going to rewrite the protocol. It's going to be exactly the same, but I'm going to change the notation a little bit so it's easier to see the pattern. So I'm going to rewrite with slightly different notation. Okay, so we have this protocol. So we have a prover and we have a verifier. Okay, what the prover does is they start by choosing this A value. And they're going to send B equals G to the A. Okay, then what the verifier is going to do is they're going to flip a coin, and I'm going to put the outcome of that coin into C. So we'll think of C as a challenge because you're kind of challenging the person. Okay, so the challenge is going to be either a 0 or a 1 as opposed to heads or tails, and we'll send C across. Okay, and then what I'm going to reply with is, let me just sketch in the answer first. So I'm either going to tell you if it's heads, which we'll consider to be 0, I'm going to tell you what A is, okay? So if when C equals 0, I just tell you what A is, or I tell you A plus X when C equals 1, okay? And we can write this equivalently as D equals C times X plus A. Okay, so notice when C is 0, this whole thing cancels and you're just left with A. When C is 1, then you get X plus A. Okay, so this is exactly equivalent notation. Then what the verifier does is they're going to check whether G to the D is the same as BY. And because we have the challenge here, we can put the challenge up here. And so notice, once again, when the challenge is 0, this term goes away. So they're just checking whether G to the D equals B. So D equals A, okay? So you're just checking whether you know G to the A equals B, okay? So that's exactly the same as before. When it's 1, then it's, does G to the D equal B times Y, okay? Which is what we were checking up here. Okay, G to the D equals B times Y raised to the power of C, but C is 1, so it doesn't actually change that value, okay? So this is a way that we can just put the C in such a way that it ends up being exactly the same in this case, okay? Now, while we're looking at this, if C is exactly the same, if this notation is exactly equivalent, okay, let me, I didn't write it in. I just see in my notes, I forgot to write it in, so I'm just going to write it. Let's go back to this, and I said it in words why this is zero knowledge, but I just want to say it, make sure it's written down in the notes. Why is this actually zero knowledge? It's zero knowledge because
when we have heads, we're not sending anything related to X. And when it's tails, we send D equals X plus A, and B equals G to the A. So this is, so A secret. Under DLP. And then D is not going to leak anything about X because we don't know anything about A. And we don't know anything about A because we don't know because of the discrete log problem. Okay, so this leaks nothing about A. If we don't know anything about A, then adding X and A together is going to leak nothing about X. That's essentially the argument. Okay. Okay, now once we have it in this notation, why are we limiting ourselves to C equals 0 or 1? Okay, what if we chose C equals 2? Well, if we choose C equals 2, we could just do the protocol the same way. The person's just challenged to send 2 times X plus A such that G to the D equals B times Y squared if the challenge is 2. So it turns out that we don't have to limit ourselves to 0 and 1, okay? If we limit ourselves to 0 and 1, what happens is we get away with it with probability 1/2, okay? Instead, what we can do is we can choose a larger challenge. So I'll call this variation. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll choose a t-bit string as C. So instead of it just being 0 or 1, it'll be a whole bunch of bits where every bit is either 0 or 1. And here the probability of getting away with it is going to be 1/2. Here it's going to increase. It's just like repeating the protocol t times. So instead of repeating 100 times, we just choose our challenge to be 100 bits. And then it's like doing the protocol 100 times, but you're actually only doing it once. Okay, so from an efficiency standpoint, it's better. So the probability of cheating is going to be 1 over 2 to the t. Okay. So notice when t equals 1, what does that mean? That means we're choosing a 1-bit string, which is either 0 or 1. That's like a coin toss. That's what we did here. So this equation tells us we get a probability 1/2, which is exactly what we got. Okay. But if we make t equal to 2, then we get 1 over 4, and then 1 over 8, and it goes down by powers of 2. Okay, and how do you cheat in this case? I'm not going to show you, but you basically cheat the same way. You try and guess what the challenge is. So remember, we had this like kind of square that look like this. And if you guessed the challenge correctly, right, you got away with it. And if you didn't guess the challenge correctly, you didn't get away with it, okay? Why does this probability go down so quick? Well, it's kind of like a, you know, think of it as a big square. And what happens is if you want to get away with it, you have to guess the challenge exactly correct. So you have to be sort of on this diagonal. But if you're wrong, then you're not going to get away with it. And so your ability to get away with it is a lot. There's a lot more X's than there are arrows. And the bigger that square gets, the ratio of X's to check marks goes up. Okay? So the probability is going to go way, way, way down the more that you do this. Okay, so you end up with a giant square where there's just, you know, the only way to get it right is like here, and then everything else is going to be wrong. Okay. Okay, we'll do one more variation on this, and then we'll talk. I'll note also here that if t equals 20, you can work out the numbers, but it gives you 99.9999% so that's the probability of actually not of it being successful, not getting away with it. Let me save that. So 1 minus the probability of cheating is the probability of getting away with it. So that's going to be 99.9%. Okay, so this goes really quick. Okay, one more variation, then we'll take a break. Okay, the second thing to notice about this protocol is this protocol is an interactive protocol, meaning you have a verifier, the verifier is online, and they're going to give you this challenge, okay? And notice the verifier can't like kind of write their challenge down ahead of time, because if they write it down ahead of time, then you'll know what the challenge is ahead of time, and then you can choose your challenge correctly, so you can always be on this sort of green line. Down here, okay? So the challenge has to be unpredictable to you. There's no way that you can know what the challenge is that's coming. So the best way of doing that is to have some person out there, a sort of challenger, who's going to give you this particular value, okay? Now, the drawback of this is if I want to prove to 10 different people that I know my private key that corresponds to my public key, I'm going to have to do an interactive protocol. So they're going to have to come online. We're both online at the same time. And I do the protocol with one person. Then I go and do the protocol with the second person and the third person, et cetera. Okay? What would be really nice is if I could just do this protocol by myself, okay, without having to interact with someone. Now, the problem is if I do it by myself, that C value has to come from somewhere, okay? And if I generate it myself, I can cheat, okay? So the only way I could do this by myself is if I could get a C value that you were convinced I didn't know ahead of time. Okay? So this sounds like it should be impossible, but let's think about it. Okay. So we call this a non-interactive proof if we could get it. Okay. So if prover proves, if they choose C, then they can cheat. Okay. So the in the interactive version, the verifier is going to choose C after the prover sends B. Because once they send B, then they either send a B that looks like this, or they send a B that looks like this, and they've locked in their choice of B, and they're not going to get away with it if the challenge ends up being different than what they predicted. Okay. So what you can do is you can think of this protocol as, let's get rid of all the math. You basically have three values that are going back and forth. So you have this B value. Who even cares what it means? Just think of it as sort of a commitment. So you're kind of locking in a way that you're going to do this proof, and then you're going to get a challenge. And then if you didn't lock it in correctly according to what you thought the challenge was, you're going to get caught when you choose your response to the challenge. Okay. So this is what the zero knowledge protocol looks like. By the way, we call this a sigma protocol. Sometimes it's called that because it kind of looks like a sigma symbol if you think of like a three line going back and forth. Okay, so what we want is we want the prover to be able to compute C themselves, okay? But they have to do it, they have to do it in a way that they can't cheat. And what does it mean in a way that they can't cheat? Well, it's sufficient if they can prove that they chose C after they computed what B is, okay? So they can prove to you, I came up with this B value, then I chose this C value. That's good enough, okay? Because then they've locked in how they're going to cheat if they're going to cheat by revealing what this B value is. So is there a way that I can give you a value C? In particular, it would be nice if it was a random value, such that you're absolutely sure that I computed this value B before I computed this value C. How can I prove to you the order in which I computed two particular values? Okay, so if I did something raised to the power of B, so why does that enforce that property?
Because I would have chosen B before and then
Okay, so you want to use a one-way function. Okay, so we're going to use a one-way function here, so that's right. So what exactly are we using it on? Okay, so a hash works as well. So a discrete log is one way, a hash is a one-way function. Let's go with the hash function. Okay, how can I use a hash function to choose C in such a way that you know that I chose B before I figured out what C was? Okay, so I can hash B and C, so I can pick two values, B and C, and then use the output as what?
Hash B and then compare it with C and hash B.
Okay, what were you saying?
Hash B, then you take the part
of C. Okay, so what we can do is, yeah, it's actually much simpler. What if we send a B value, and then we say, hey, the C value that we're choosing is going to be the hash of B. And if the challenge is smaller than the output of the hash, then we can truncate it down, okay? Is it possible for me to compute what value I want C to be and then compute B? It's not. Why is it not possible? Pre-image resistance, right? So if I say I want the challenge to be all zeros, like 20 zeros, well, I would have to find a B value that hashes to 20 zeros, right? How hard is that going to be? All right, it's going to be 1 over 2 to the 20, okay? So if my challenge is T bits and I need a challenge value to come out, a hash to come out to a certain number of T bits, then it's going to be 1 over 2 to the T values of B that I have to try before, okay? So as long as I make my challenge big enough, I'm not going to be able to do that particular attack.
Okay, so this is a sound non-interactive version of the same protocol. Okay, so it's exactly the same except for we choose our challenge using the hash at B. It has a fancy name. We call it the Fiat Shamir heuristic because it was invented by two people named Fiat and Shamir. Okay, so once again, if I want to prove to 10 people that I know the public key that corresponds to a private key, then all I do is I just do this once and I give the same copy of the proof to 10 different people. Okay? Now, in that case, let's say you're one of those 10 people. Well, you could take that proof and you could replay it as well and say, well, I know the value of this this proof, or I know the value of this by replaying that exact proof. Okay? So what I need to do further is I need to tie that proof to me somehow. Okay? So I want to say, here's a non-interactive zero proof, zero knowledge proof, and it's somehow tied to me, okay? And so the trick that we're going to do is we're going to tie it by hashing in basically our identity into the hash function. So if I put my name at the end of this, I can hash it down to C. It still has all the security properties, and now this proof is sort of stapled to my identity, okay? Then what we can do is we can think more broadly, and we can say, well, I could put any message into that hash, and now you have this zero knowledge proof that's sort of stapled to a message, okay? So you have a message, and the only person that could staple that proof to the message is the person that knows the private key that corresponds to a given public key, okay? And so that's a very useful primitive that we'll call a signature scheme. So what's a signature scheme? Well, it's basically a zero knowledge proof that I know my secret key stapled to a message. So I take a message I want to sign, and I staple a proof to it saying I know the private key that corresponds to this public key, and that's a signature function. That's a signature on that particular message using that particular key, okay? And the exact way we staple it is by putting it in the hash function, okay? So that's what we'll talk about after the break, but in the meantime, go take a coffee break or whatever for 10 minutes and come back. Yeah, all right, we'll get started again.
No, just send me your email. Your mom's email. Just send me your email account.
All right, so I'll give you another variation, the signature that we just sort of talked about. Okay, so the idea here is we're going to staple a message to a zero-knowledge proof by including it in the hash value that generates the challenge. Now, every message is going to give us a different challenge value, and the only person that can actually answer the challenges is the person who knows that private key, okay? So when you see a message stapled to one of these proofs, it's basically saying the person who knows that key, they signed this message or they endorsed this message, okay? So we take it as a signature. Okay, so we don't have a verifier. Well, we can still think of a verifier. So the prover is going to just do everything they do. So they're going to choose an A, they'll send B equals U to the A. Now the prover is going to choose the challenge instead of the verifier. They're going to make it the hash of B. And then what they'll do is they'll stick their message, say, on the end. And then they'll send d equals cx plus. Okay? Okay? And we can think of these three values, b, c, d, as a signature. Okay? So we can interpret this as... So basically what happens is, we have the prover and the verifier. And so what the prover is going to send to the verifier is B, C, D. And then they'll send the message along as well, because you want to verify that the signature matches a particular message. Okay. So what we get is, I'll write it down here as well. So generally, for a signature scheme, you're also going to send the message itself. So it's just like a MAC. A signature offers no confidentiality. It's not about keeping things secret. It's about proving that the person who sent it actually sent it. It wasn't modified in the middle. Okay. So they'll send M, and then they'll send B, C, D. And so these three values we sometimes denote like this. Okay. And how do I verify that this is actually a valid signature? First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the message that I received, and I'm going to recompute what the challenge should be. So I'm going to figure out what's the hash of this B value I sent and this message. Okay, so that will give me the C value. Then I'll check whether B times Y equals G to the C. Sorry. B times Y to the C equals G to the D. Okay, so I'll compute this C, I'll use it in this equation, and then if this holds, it's valid. Otherwise, it's not valid. Okay? So this works as a signature. Let me rewrite it once again, sort of switching the notation. This time, it will be the exact same protocol, but we'll think of it as more conventionally what a signature would look like. Okay, so we have Alice, we have Bob. And what Alice is going to do is she's going to send a message and a signature, okay? And what does Alice know? Well, she knows some secret key, okay? And she holds some public key value, okay? And this is public, so Bob is able to get this public key value. So we can think of that actually as the first flow, is Bob gets the public key, goes to Alice's website, whatever the case is, knows the public key of Alice, and then we get the message and the signature itself. So the signature we sometimes denote as the signature using secret key SK on message. Okay. If we think of a signature scheme in isolation, we have three algorithms. So there's key generation. Key generation works the same as in ElGamel. Your secret key is X, and your public key is what we call Y, which equals G to the X. We have a signature algorithm. So to sign, we're going to sign under using our secret key, or using X, some message, and some randomness. And this is going to be the three values B, C, D. We can call the output sigma, that's often what we call it. So this is G to the randomness. So I just renamed it R instead of A, but it doesn't matter. C is going to be the hash of our B value, along with our message. And our last one is going to be r plus cx. Okay, then we have a verification algorithm. So the verification algorithm is going to return either true or false. It's going to take the public key of the person who allegedly signed it. It's going to take the message, and it's going to take the signature value, and it's going to output true under two cases. So it's going to check whether the challenge is actually the hash of B and M. And it's going to check whether G to the D equals B times Y to the C. What's Y? Y is the public key. Okay. See if I can get this on one page. Okay, so that's a signature algorithm. So what does a signature algorithm let you do? Well, you post a public key, then you can go around signing any message you want, and people are sure that you are the person who signed that, or more specifically, that your public key signed that message. Okay? Now, there's two algorithms that we have in practice. So this algorithm that I just showed you is actually called the Schnorr signature. There's a variant of Schnorr that's used in practice called DSA. So DSA is more common. DSA is exactly the same as Schnorr. The only difference is how you compute this last D value. Okay, so here D is computed as R plus CX. So that's the case in Schnorr. In DSA, it's computed as A inverse times C plus BX. Why is it different? It's actually different because it was invented first. So Schnorr came up with this idea that a signature is basically a zero-knowledge proof stapled into a message. DSA was invented slightly before that knowledge, and they basically stumbled on the same idea, but they didn't really appreciate the full generality of it. So Schnorr is a much cleaner proof. You can actually prove that it's secure. DSA, it's tricky. You can't. Sort of impossible to prove that it's actually secure without making some very strong assumptions. Because this came first, it was sort of asserted to be true. Then Schnorr came along and proved that this actually was secure, and you can see very clearly that it's secure if the zero-knowledge proof that it's based on is secure. And this looks almost the same as this, so we're pretty sure this is secure if this is secure. But it's just sort of a historical artifact, the fact that we use this variant instead of this variant. Okay. Yeah. So I did change it to an R at some point here. Yet. So I actually just have inconsistent notation here. So yeah, let's just make this A that's consistent. So yeah, sorry, I use R here as instead of A. But yeah, but this A is the same as this A. Okay, a few notes on just sort of the implementation. For both Schnorr and DSA, if you use the same value A, which is the randomness, to sign two different messages, you can look at those two signatures and you can actually compute what the private key is. So I'm not going to show you why this is the case. I'll leave it for homework. So you can play along with it or play around with it. I'll just show you, I'll try and give you the intuition of it. When you look at this value, D equals A plus CX, everyone knows what C is, that's public. No one knows what A is and no one knows what X is. Okay, so you have one equation and two unknowns. Okay, now if you produce two D values that both have the same A value, okay, now you're going to have two equations and your X value is the same because your key didn't change and your A value is going to be the same because you happen to use the same A value twice. So now you're going to have two equations and two unknowns. Okay, and you can solve that. Okay, so you can, when it's, and if you choose a different A every time, then you're always going to have, you'll have a new equation, but you're going to have a new unknown for every single equation. Okay, so that's the intuition of why this works. But you can work out the details and show, see for yourself how exactly you compute X if you use this, the same value of A twice. Okay, the second thing is that if you're going to break the signature algorithm or break Fiat-Shamir, you're going to try and guess what the challenge is and you're going to try and get along this line, okay? And that's going to happen with very small probability depending on how big you make T, okay? But the thing is because it's non-interactive, what you can do is if you guess a challenge and then you compute your B value according to what you think the challenge will be, and then when you hash it, it turns out the challenge isn't what you guessed, you can just throw it away and start again. And no one knows that you even tried it. It's not like an interactive version where you're getting caught all the time, okay? So you can just sort of grind out a solution through exhaustive search where eventually you guess what this challenge of C is, and then when you actually take the hash of B, it actually turns out to match what your guess is, okay? So what we have to do is we have to make sure that that's impossible or infeasible, computationally infeasible. So that kind of exhaustive search, we have to make sure that you have to do 2^112 work in order to do it. So the probability of that working has to be 1/2^112. So that means that this T value is going to have to be at least 112 bits. So 1/T to the 112 will work, okay? Now, we're going to have a complexity here in a sec. Okay, so the hash function should be at least, the challenge should be at least 112 bits, so that So the probability of a guess value being correct is 1 over 2 to the 112. In other words, you'd have to do 2 to the 112 guesses in order to find a correct value, which is infeasible. However, we also want collision resistance. Why do we want collision resistance? Okay. So if we can find two messages such that the hash of B and M turns out to be the same value, then a signature on the one message is going to be exactly equivalent to a signature on the other message. Okay? So we'd be able to substitute in it as well. Okay, so as a result, what we actually want is we want the output of C to be greater than 224 bits. Sorry, so we need a double for collision resistance. Okay, the third thing is remember that even though we sort of haven't talked about it in a while, we're doing all this on the integers mod p. What that means is that all of these numbers have a sort of maximum size, right? They can never be larger than p, because if they're larger than p, then they get mod down to p, okay? So what we have to ask ourselves is, can we send messages of any length? Can we sign a message of arbitrary length? So that's what we'd ideally want from a signature scheme. I didn't draw it in, but I should draw it in now that I'm thinking of it. Okay, so ideally what we'd want is we want M to be of any size that we chose. Okay, so if I want to sign the entire contents of my hard drive, that should be possible. Okay, in DSA, what happens if I sign some really large amount of data? Okay, so P could be bigger than it, then it certainly wouldn't be a problem. But look again. So where is the message going into the signature? So it's going into a hash. What's the hash going to do? It's going to shrink it down, okay? So what that means is that this actually, out of the box, it will work. You can use it to sign any size of data because it's going to get hashed down. And as long as the hash output is 256, and as long as your group can, your exponents are bigger than 256 bits, then you have no problem at all. Okay, you can fit an entire hash value in this particular value of C. So note that C goes up in an exponent. Okay, so the third thing is because messages are hashed, you can sign messages of any length. And because of collision resistance, you're not going to be able to find two messages that are going to produce the same hash. Therefore, it's just like you signed all the data, even if you're just signing the hash. Okay. Yeah. So they would have to be the same in this particular case, the way it is. Now, if you put B at the end, then they wouldn't have to be the same, assuming your message fit into a perfect block. But in general, in the most general case, yeah, the Bs would have to be the same. So it does change. So this attack's a little weird. It's not as sort of powerful as you would think it is, because you basically have the person who's actually signing it be the one who's generating the collision, because they're the ones that are choosing that B value. And of course, if they want to transfer a signature to a different message, they can just sign the second message. But there's a few scenarios where maybe they sign something and then someone signs on top and then they swap the message out on you. Those are the kinds of scenarios where this could come into play. Okay. So this is sometimes called the hash and sign paradigm. And later in the video that I'll put up, you'll see RSA signatures. In RSAs, it doesn't naturally go through a hash function. There's no hash function in the RSA signature. So as a result, you have to explicitly hash first. So you take your message, you hash it down. Now you have something that's going to fit in the number theory, the group that you're using, and then you can put it in the RSA signature. But for DSA, it just works out of the box because there's already a hash function there. Okay, let's go back to Diffie-Hellman. So Diffie-Hellman was the protocol that we looked at as the first thing in this section. Okay, so before we said that, you know, Diffie-Hellman works fine as long as your adversary is only an eavesdropper. They're only going to listen in on the channel. They're not going to change messages. So first off, why is it the case that we care about this? So let's consider what happens when we have an eavesdropper that can change messages. So just to recall, Diffie-Hellman is Alice sends G to the A, Bob sends G to the B, okay, and both parties can compute G to the AB. Okay, so now let's consider the same scenario, and we'll consider the case where there's an adversary in the middle. Call her Eve. Okay, so let's say Alice sends G to the A, and Eve intercepts it in the middle. Eve doesn't have to send G to the A if she wants. She could change that to some other value. Okay, in particular, what she could do is... So we'll assume that Alice has A here, Bob has B. Let's say that Eve chooses another value. We'll call it A prime, and she sends G to the A prime instead to Bob. Okay, so Bob gets this G to the A prime. He thinks that this is from Alice. This is Alice's A, but it really isn't Alice's A. Okay, then Bob goes ahead and says, okay, I'm going to reply with my G to the B, and the adversary does the same trick. She chooses G to the B prime and sends it along instead. Okay? What's going to happen in these scenarios? Okay, so what Alice is going to do is she says, well, I sent G to the A, I got this G to the B prime, so I'm going to take G to the B prime and raise it to my power of A. Okay, so the key that I'm going to use is going to be G to the B prime, which I got. I'm going to raise it to my power A. And so she'll end up using G to the B prime A, or let me rewrite this. We'll keep it in order. So A to the B prime. Okay? So that's fine. Now, does Bob actually know this key? No, he doesn't. Okay? Bob has no idea what this key is. Okay? What does Bob do? Well, Bob gets G to the A prime, and he's going to raise that to the power of B. Okay? So he's going to have A prime B. Okay? So... Alice will start encrypting messages under this value. Bob will be decrypting messages under this value, so they're not going to be able to talk to each other, okay? But what does the adversary know? So the adversary is in the middle, and what the adversary can do is the adversary saw G to the A, right? And she knows what B prime is because she sent it. So she can compute. Let me call these different values to emphasize that they're different. So we'll call this KA because that's what Alice computes, and we'll call this KB. So that's what Bob computes. The adversary can compute the same key as KA. Okay. What she'll do is she'll take G to the A and raise it to B prime. So that equals G to the A, B prime. Okay. And she also knows KB because she can take G to the B and raise it to the A prime. Okay. So Alice will encrypt under KA. The adversary knows the decryption key, so she'll just decrypt it. Then she'll re-encrypt it under KB and send it to Bob, and Bob will decrypt it under KB. Then Bob will make a response. He'll encrypt it under KB, send it to the adversary. The adversary will decrypt it with KB, re-encrypt it under KA, and then send it off to Alice, who can decrypt it under KA. Okay, so the adversary can sit in the middle. So this is, we call it a man-in-the-middle attack, which is sexist, I know, but anyways, think of it as person in the middle. So a person in the middle attack, so the Eve is sitting in the middle, she can relay the information, okay? So essentially what happened is it's kind of like Alice did Diffie-Hellman with Eve, and then Eve did Diffie-Hellman with Bob, okay? And so she just sits in the middle and just decrypts everything and then re-encrypts it for Alice and relays the messages back and forth, okay? Okay, so how do we solve this problem? Okay, hashes, signatures. Okay, if we have a signature, how's this going to solve? Who can sign what? Okay, so if Alice signs GA, can Eve change it to A prime? Why not? She doesn't know the key for the signature algorithm, okay? So Alice will send G to the A, and then Alice will sign G to the A using her key. Well, I'll just call it A, even though it's a little ambiguous, but that's her public key. And Bob will send G to the B, and we'll sign G to the B. Okay, and it turns out it's actually sufficient if Alice can just send G to the A, and Bob can sign both his G to the B and the G to the A that he received. And so if the adversary changed either of the two, it's going to break the signature. So they both, technically, if you want to save one signature, they both don't have to sign. Bob can just sign what he received. But we'll leave it like this. Okay? And so both of them will verify the signature and then compute G to the AB. Okay, so this solution is called the station-to-station protocol. K
Okay, so it's just Diffie-Hellman with signatures. Now it's secure against active adversaries, and so this is fine. You can use this, actually what's used on the web. So let me show you the simpler variant with just the one signature function, because I realize that it actually is important. So in the simpler version, Alice sends G to the A, which the adversary is free to change because it's not signed. But then what's going to happen is Bob's going to send back G to the B and a signature using Bob's key on both G to the A and G to the B. Okay. And so if this G to the A doesn't match the G to the A that Alice sent, then she knows that there was an adversary in the middle that changed it. So she'll abort the protocol and... Okay, this version's a little nicer because in this version, both Alice and Bob have to have public keys. Here, only Bob has to have a public key. So that makes a big difference when we think about the web and how the web works. So that's why I wanted to show this variant. Okay. Okay, so there's one last problem as far as Diffie-Hellman's concerned. And that's, how does Alice get Bob's public key? So if Bob is going to sign this message, then Alice has to get Bob's public key somehow, right? So how does Alice get that key? So she could ask, hey, Bob, what's your public key? Then what would happen if we had an active adversary in the middle? Bob would send his public key, the adversary would replace it with her public key. And then if the adversary's public key is the one that's signing, then the adversary can do this. She can do this protocol. She can make up G to the A prime and G to the B prime and sign the values. Okay. So did we actually solve a problem? We added all these signatures. It looks like we're solving a problem, but we didn't really solve it because we still have this problem of, well, how does Alice know what Bob's public key is? Okay, so the solution to this is called PKI, or public key infrastructure. Okay, and let's actually back way up. So before we think about public keys, how does Alice know what Bob's public key is? Let's think of an even more general case, which is, let's say we're just doing AES. How do Alice and Bob even get symmetric keys? Okay. And so in a symmetric key world, let's assume that whatever, let's sort of punt on the issue of how they get the key. Let's just assume they meet in person or something like that. But let's just think about how many keys there are. So let's say that we have like five people that talk to each other, okay? So Alice, Bob, Carol, David, Eve, whatever. They all talk to each other. In a symmetric key world, Alice and Bob would have one key, right? And Alice and Carol would have another key, and Alice and Carol and David would have another key. And then these two people would all have keys. And basically everyone would have a key with everybody else, okay?
And so what we'll get is n choose 2 keys, which is approximately n squared keys. Okay? Now, with public keys, in this case, what happens is Alice has one key, and all of these recipients can use the same key for Alice. Okay? Bob has one key, and all these recipients can use the same key. Okay, so everyone just has a public key. Okay, and everybody can use the public key. Okay, so how many public keys do we have in this case? Well, we just have n keys. Okay, so that's a little bit better. So if we want to scale a system of cryptography up, it's better to have n keys than n squared keys. But we still have this problem of how do I actually know that that's Alice's public key or if that's Bob's public key? So now instead of having to solve that problem for every person I interact with and every key possible pair, now there's less keys in order to solve it. Okay. Now the final solution is what we call a certificate authority. So in certificate authority, we have one trusted sort of institution. So you could think of it as Concordia. And Concordia has a public key. Okay? And what the Concordia is going to do is if Alice wants a public key, what she's going to go is she's going to go over to Concordia and say, hey, will you sign my public key? Okay? So Alice will have a public key that's going to be signed by the CA. So the CA will sign this particular public key. And when you sign a public key, that's just called a certificate. And when you sign the public key, you can include other information like the person's name or whatever the particular case is. Okay? So this we call a certificate. Okay, now what happens is, let's say you're Alice and you're talking to Bob and you're like, hey, Bob, what's your public key? Now Bob can just send it over the wire because he'll send his public key and he'll also send the certificate, which says it's actually his public key. And the adversary can't change that because she doesn't know the signing key of the certificate authority. Okay, so in this scheme, you only need to know one key, which is you need to know the certificate authority's key. If you know the certificate authority's key and that certificate authority signs everyone else's key, then when you get a key, you'll just check that it's signed with the one key that you know, which is the certificate authority's key. Then you'll believe that that's actually that person's real key. Okay? So Alice no longer has to figure out what Bob's key is, but Alice has to figure out what the certificate authority's key is. Okay? And then that certificate authority has to sign Alice, Bob, Carol, all the people's keys. Then everyone can figure out what each other's keys are. Okay, so this looks nice in practice. So it sort of reduces it to one key that you have to know. Okay, so everyone just has to know this one key, which is the CA key. Okay, the problem with it is who is the CA, right? Who's the CA going to be, right? Who's the person that goes around signing keys? And then another question is, well, how does the CA figure out that Alice is Alice? So if Alice comes along and says, I'm Alice, will you sign my key? Then the CA has to figure that question out, right? So anyways, what we've done is we haven't really solved the problem of how does Alice know what Bob's public key is. But what we've done is we've sort of shrunk it down in terms of instead of Alice having to know all the keys with all the people that she talks to, she just has to know one key of a certificate authority, and the certificate authority is going to go around signing everyone's keys. Okay? So this is how the web works. So for example, if you go to Google and you say, and it has that lock, what that means is you have a secure connection to Google. And somebody said that that's actually Google's public key, okay? And what you'll do is your computer will literally do Diffie-Hellman with Google. And once you do Diffie-Hellman with Google, then you'll get a symmetric key. And then once you have a symmetric key, you'll switch to AES with HMAC or whatever GCM, whatever mode you want. And then you'll actually do all the crypto, okay? So everything that we said in class, all the little pieces, they all come together into a protocol that you'll actually use, okay? So in the last class of the of this course, we'll actually look at TLS. So that protocol is called TLS, the thing on the web, and I'll show you how it actually works, and I'll also show you what these certificates look like. I'll show you like the actual negotiation, the protocols that are negotiated, and you'll see all the things that we talked about in class basically all put together. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what's the relationship between an HMAC and a signature? They're exactly the same thing, except for a signature is the public key version of the HMAC. So in an HMAC, you're going to have a shared key with all the people that you know, and in a signature, there'll be only one key. Yeah. So they're identical in terms of what they provide. Yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay. Let me just jump over to the assignment real quick. So there were a few questions, so I'm just going to clarify a few things. I'm going to make one more revision to the assignment, so I added a few things. but if you've not looked at the assignment, question one should be very straightforward. You're basically using all of these algorithms. Everything's there. It's really just copying out of the notes and sort of seeing the numbers. It's more to convince you that it works and getting you used to actually doing things and actually be a little bit challenging. Question two is a little challenging in the sense that you have to think a little bit about what's actually going on. So what you have is you have this block cipher, and what they're doing is you're choosing an IV because it's counter mode, and then you're going to encrypt three particular values, okay? And these three values are going to be broken up into different blocks, okay? So depending on how long your message is, you're going to use anywhere between one and, you know, infinity number of blocks, okay? So you'll have some messages, and this block here is the plain text. So this is before encryption has been applied. So you'll have a bunch of blocks that are just messages. And then in the last block, what you're going to have is you're going to have the tail end of the message, whatever doesn't fit. You're going to put a MAC on the end, okay? And the MAC is going to be 40 bits. And then what's going to happen is you're going to do some padding, okay? And the way the question is worded is the padding scheme is going to be very specific, okay? So what the padding scheme is going to tell you is you're going to figure out how close are you to filling up this last block, okay? So you're going to be short by some amount of data. So let's say that you need 5 bytes of padding. What you're going to do is you're going to take the number 5, you're going to put it in binary, and you're going to repeat that number 5 times. Okay, so it'll be 5, 5, 5, 5, 5 as a byte. Okay, that's what the padding looks like. If you need 6 bytes of padding, it's going to be 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, 6 times. Okay, if it's 2 bytes of padding, it's going to be 2 repeated twice. And if it's 1 byte of padding, it'll be just 1 repeated once. Okay, so that's what the padding scheme will look like. Now, what I suggest you do when you think about this, I should have made it a sub problem and actually gave you marks for doing it. But what you should think about before you tackle the problem is when Bob decrypts it, what exactly does he do? Okay. So when he decrypts this message, it sort of walks through in English what he does. But the hint I'm going to give you is I'm going to tell you exactly what he's going to do. Okay. So when he decrypts, he's going to recover a bunch of blocks, and the last block will look something like this, and this block will look like this, okay? And when he decrypts, he's not going to look at the whole message at first, okay? He can start making some decisions about what to do without actually looking at everything, okay? So the very first place he's going to look is he's going to look at the last block before he looks at anything else. So he looks at the first block, and there's going to be a number there, okay? And if that number is 5,
then what he's going to do is he's going to expect five blocks that have the number 5, okay? So the second thing he's going to do is look at the last 5 blocks and make sure they're all 5. If they're not all 5, he's going to throw an error and say there's a padding error, okay? So the number of blocks he looks at is going to depend on what number is actually sitting here, okay? So he can decide whether there's a padding error or not before he actually does anything. Yeah. A block is 128 bits. Then you'll expect 5 bytes of padding. And another thing, too, just for your own interest, doesn't really factor into the question. You can have a block that's entirely padding. Okay, so you can pad out. You can pad as long as you want, technically. Normally you pad until you finish that block, but if you want to pad a whole new block, you can do that. And if you have a message that fits perfectly, so you don't need to do padding, you still have to pad. Because Bob, when he decrypts, he doesn't know whether you use padding or not. He'll just look at the last block, okay? So he doesn't know that, oh, that wasn't padding because your message fit perfectly. So you always pad. So if you have a message where it ends exactly at the end of a block, then you have to pad the whole next block entirely, okay? But anyway, that's not really essential to asking the question unless if you're going to go through every corner case. But anyways, so Bob looks at the first block. It tells him a number. Then he's going to look at that number of – sorry, I know why we're getting confused. I use the term block. He's going to look at the last byte, pardon me, and there's going to be a number in the last byte, okay? And whatever that number is, he's going to look at that number of bytes to see that the padding matches, including the last byte, okay? And that's going to tell him whether it's a padding error or not, okay? Once he's done that, then he's going to remove those bytes that he looked at, okay? So if I go here, I see 2. So step 1 is it's 2. Step 2 is 2 repeated twice? Yes, 2 is repeated twice. Step 3, these 2 bytes are padding, so I'm going to get rid of them, okay? Step 3 is the next 40 bytes is going to be the MAC, okay? And then the next step is, now I'm going to look at the whole message, I'm going to pump it through the key and the MAC algorithm and make sure it comes out to this particular A value, okay? If it does, then I say successful decryption. If I put all of this through and it doesn't match the 40 bits that are sitting here, then I say MAC error, okay? So those are the steps that Bob will do. So look at the last byte, then look at N copies of the last byte depending on what's sitting there, okay? Then parse whatever 40 bits are the next 40 bits, okay? So maybe that's the MAC, maybe it's not, right? So that's what you got to think about. But he's going to interpret the next 40 bits as the MAC, regardless of whether it actually is the MAC or not. And then he's going to try and run the message with the key through that MAC value. And if any bit is different in either the MAC or the message, then you're going to get MAC error. Otherwise, you're going to successfully decrypt, okay? And the crux of the problem is, whether he's telling you it's a padding error or a MAC error is actually going to be very, very significant. You can use that information to, at the end of the day, you can actually decrypt this entire message just by knowing whether or not something was a MAC error or a padding error. So it's actually a real-life attack. It's very damaging. SSL was vulnerable to it, and then they kind of fixed it, but then it was kind of vulnerable to it. And anyways, eventually in TLS 1.3, it should be fixed for good. Okay, good luck with that. All right, we'll see you all next week.